This is Reading the Classics, and I am Kelly Johnson of the Ketchikan Public Library. Today, I'd like to share with you some of the extraordinary adventures of Arsène Lupin, Gentleman Burglar, by Maurice Leblanc. 1. The Arrest of Arsène Lupin. It was a strange ending to a voyage that had commenced in a most auspicious manner. The transatlantic steamship La Provence was a swift and comfortable vessel under the command of a most affable man. The passengers constituted a select and delightful society. The charm of new acquaintances and improvised amusements served to make the time pass agreeably. We enjoyed the pleasant sensation of being separated from the world, living, as it were, upon an unknown island, and consequently obliged to be sociable with each other. Have you ever stopped to consider how much originality and spontaneity emanate from these various individuals who on the preceding evening did not know each other and who are now for several days condemned to lead a life of extreme intimacy, jointly defying the anger of the ocean, the terrible onslaught of the waves, the violence of the tempest, and the agonizing monotony of the calm and sleepy water. Such a life becomes a sort of tragic existence with its storms and grandeurs, its monotony and diversity, and that is why, perhaps, we embark upon the short voyage with mingled feelings of pleasure and fear. But during the past few years, a new sensation has been added to the life of transatlantic traveler. The little floating island is now attached to the world from which it was once quite free. A bond united them, even then, in the heart of the watery waste of the Atlantic. That bond is the wireless telegraph, by means of which we receive news from the most mysterious manner. We know full well that the message is not transported by the medium of hollow wire. No, the mystery is even more inexplicable, more romantic, and we must have recourse to the wings of the air in order to explain this new miracle. During the first day of the voyage, we felt that we were being followed, escorted, preceded even by that distant voice which from time to time whispered to one of us a few words from the receding world. Two friends spoke to me. 10, 20 others sent gay or somber words of parting to the other passengers. On the second day, a distance of 500 miles from the French coast, in the midst of a violent storm, we received the following message by means of the wireless telegraph. Arsène Lupin is on your vessel. First cabin. Blonde hair. Wound right forearm. Traveling alone under the name of At that moment, a terrible flash of lightning rent the stormy skies. The electric waves were interrupted. The remainder of the dispatch never reached us. Of the name under which Arsène Lupin was concealing himself, we only know the initial. If the news had been of some other character, I have no doubt the secret would have been carefully guarded by the telegraphic operator, as well as by the officers of the vessel. But it was one of those events calculated to escape from the most rigorous discretion. The same day, no one knew how, the incident became a matter of current gossip, and every passenger was aware that the famous Arsène Lupin was hiding in our midst. Arsène Lupin, in our midst, the irresponsible burglar whose exploits had been narrated in all the newspapers during the past few months, the mysterious individual with whom Ganimard, our shrewdest detective, had been engaged in an implacable conflict amidst interesting and picturesque surroundings, Arsène Lupin, the eccentric gentleman who operates only in the chateaus and salons, and who one night entered the residence of Baron Schormann but emerged empty-handed, leaving, however, his card on which he had scribbled these words. Arsène Lupin, gentleman burglar, will return when the furniture is genuine. Arsène Lupin, the man of 1,000 disguises, in turn a chauffeur, detective, bookmaker, Russian physician, Spanish bullfighter, commercial traveler, robust youth, or decrepit old man. Then consider this startling situation. Arsène Lupin was wandering about within the limited bounds of a transatlantic steamer. In that very small corner of the world, in that dining salon, in that smoking room, in that music room, Arsene Lupin was perhaps this gentleman or that one, my neighbor at the table, the sheriff of my stateroom. And this condition of affairs will last for 5 days, exclaimed Miss Nellie Underdown next morning. It is unbearable. I hope he will be arrested. Then, addressing me, she added, and you, Monsieur de Darzay, you are in intimate terms with the captain. Surely you know something. I should have been delighted. I had possessed any information that would interest Miss Nellie. She was one of those magnificent creatures who inevitably attract the attention in every assembly. Wealth and beauty from form, and an irresistible combination, and Nellie possessed all. Educated in Paris under the care of a French mother, she was now going to visit her father, the millionaire Underdown of Chicago. She was accompanied by one of her friends, Lady Jerland. At first, I had decided to open a flirtation with her, but in the rapidly growing intimacy of the voyage, I was soon impressed by her charming manner, and my feelings became too deep and reverential for mere flirtation. Moreover, she accepted my attentions with a certain degree of favor. She condescended to laugh at my witticisms and display an interest in my stories. Yet I felt that I had a rival in the person of a young man with quiet and refined tastes, and it struck me at times that she preferred his taciturn humor to my Parisian frivolity. He formed one in the circle of admirers that surrounded Miss Nellie at the time she addressed to me the foregoing question. We were all comfortably seated in our deck chairs. The storm of the preceding evening had cleared the sky. The weather was now delightful. "I have no definite knowledge, mademoiselle," I replied, "but can we not ourselves investigate the mystery quite as well as the detective Gamard, the personal enemy of Arsène Lupin?" Oh, you are progressing very fast, monsieur." "Not at all, mademoiselle. In the first place, let me ask, do you find the problem a complicated one?" "Very complicated." "Have you forgotten the key we hold to the solution of the problem?" "What key?" "In the first place, Lupin calls himself Monsieur R." "Rather vague information," she replied. "Secondly, he is traveling alone." "Does that help you?" she asked. "Thirdly, he is blonde." "Well, then we have only to pursue the passenger list and proceed by process of elimination." I had that list in my pocket. I took it out and glanced through it. Then I remarked, "I find that there are only 13 men on the passenger's list whose name begin with the letter R." "Only 13? "Yes, in the first cabin, and those 13 I find that 9 of them are accompanied by women, children, or servants. That leaves only 4 who are traveling alone. First, the Marquise de Ravern." "Secretary of the Ambassador, American Ambassador," interrupted Miss Nellie. "I know him." "Major Rawson," I continued. "He's my uncle," someone said. "Mon Rivolta." "Here," exclaimed an Italian whose face was concealed beneath a heavy black beard. Miss Nellie burst into laughter and exclaimed, "That gentleman can scarcely be called a blonde." "Very well, then," I said. "We are forced to the conclusion that the guilty party is the last one on the list. What is his name?" "Mon Rosain." "Does anyone know him?" No one answered, but Miss Nellie turned to the taciturn young man whose attention to her had annoyed me and said, "Well, Monsieur Rosain, why do you not answer?" All eyes were now turned upon him. He was a blonde. I must confess that I myself felt a shock of surprise, and the profound silence that followed her question indicates others present also viewed the situation with a feeling of sudden alarm. However, the idea was an absurd one, because the gentleman in question presented an air of most perfect innocence. "Why do I not answer?" he said. "Because, considering my name, my position as a solitary traveler, and the color of my hair, I have already reached the same conclusion, and now think that I should be arrested." He presented a strange appearance as he uttered these words. His thin lips were drawn closer than usual. His face was ghastly pale, while his eyes were streaked with blood. Of course, he was joking, that his appearance and attitude impressed us strangely. "But have you not the wound?" said Miss Nelly naively. "This is true," he replied. "I lack the wound." Then he pulled up his sleeve, removing his cuff, and showed us his arm. But that action did not deceive me. He had shown us his left arm, and I was at the point of calling his attention to the fact when another incident diverted our attention. Lady Jerland, Miss Nelly's friend, came running towards us in a state of great excitement, exclaiming, "My jewels, my pearls, someone has stolen them all." No, they were not all gone, we soon found out. The thief had only taken part of them. A very curious thing. Of the diamond sunbursts, jewel pendants, bracelets, and necklaces, the thief had taken not the largest, but the finest and most valuable stones. The mountings were lying upon the table. I saw them there, despoiled of their jewels, like flowers from which the beautiful colored petals had been ruthlessly plucked. And this theft must have been committed at this time Lady Jerland was taking her tea in broad daylight in a stateroom opening on a much frequented corridor. Moreover, the thief had been obliged to force open the door of the stateroom, search for the jewel case which was hidden in the bottom of a hat box, open it, select his booty, and remove it from the mountings. Of course, all the passengers instantly reached the same conclusion. It was the work of Arsene Lupin. That day, at the dinner table, the seats to the right and left of Rosane remained vacant, and during the evening it was rumored that the captain had placed him under arrest, which information produced a feeling of safety and relief. We breathed once more. That evening we resumed our games and dances. Miss Nelly especially displayed a spirit of thoughtless gaiety which convinced me if Rosane's attentions had been agreeable to her in the beginning, she had already forgotten them. Her charm and good humor completed my conquest. At midnight, under a bright moon, I declared my devotion with an ardor that did not seem to displease her. But next day, to our general amazement, Rosane was at liberty. We learned that the evidence against him was not sufficient. He produced documents that were perfectly regular, which showed that he was the son of a wealthy British merchant. His arms did not bear the slightest trace of a wound. "Documents, certificates of birth," exclaimed enemies of Rosane. "Of course Arsene Lupin will furnish you as many as you desire, and as to the wound, he never had it or he has removed it." Then it was proven that at the time of the theft Rosane was promenading on the deck, to which fact his enemies replied that a man like Arsene Lupin could commit a crime without actually being present, and then, apart from all the other circumstances, there remained one point which even the most skeptical could not answer. Who, except Rosane, was traveling alone, was blonde, and bore the name beginning with R? To whom did the telegram point if it were not Rosane? And when Rosane, a few minutes before breakfast, came boldly towards our group, Miss Nelly and Lady Jerland arose and walked away. An hour later, a manuscript circular was passed from hand to hand amongst the sailors, the stewards, and the passengers of all classes. It announced that Mon Louis Rosane offered a reward of 10,000 francs for the discovery of Arsene Lupin or other person in possession of the stolen jewels. "And if no one assists me, I will amass the scoundrel myself," declared Rosane. Rosane against Arsene Lupin, or rather, according to current opinion, Arsene Lupin against himself, the contest promised something interesting. Nothing developed during the next 2 days. We saw Rosane wandering about day and night, searching, questioning, investigating. The captain also displayed commendable activity. He caused the vessel to be searched from stem to stern, ransacked every stateroom under the plausible theory that the jewels might be concealed anywhere except the thief's own room. "I suppose they will find something soon," remarked Miss Nelly to me. "He may be a wizard, but he cannot make diamonds and pearls become invisible." "Certainly not," I replied, "but he should examine the lining of our hats and vests and everything we carry with us." Then, exhibiting my Kodak, a 9x12, with which I had been photographing her in various poses, I added, "An apparatus no larger than that, a person could hide all of Lady Jerland's jewels. He could pretend to take picture, and no one would suspect the game. But I have heard it said that every thief leaves some clues behind him." "That may be generally true," I replied, "but there is one exception, Arsene Lupin." "Why?" because he concentrates his thoughts not only on the theft, but on all circumstances connected with that that could serve as a clue to his identity. A few days ago, you were more confident. Yes, but since then, I have seen him at work. And what do you think about it now? She asked. Well, in my opinion, we are wasting our time. As a matter of fact, the investigation produced no results. But in the meantime, the captain's watch had been stolen. He was furious. He quickened his effort and watched Rosane more closely than before. But on the following day, the watch was found in the second officer's collar box. This incident caused considerable astonishment and displayed the humorous side of Arsène Lupin, burglar though he was, but dilettante as well. He combined business with pleasure. He reminded us of the author who almost died in a fit of laughter provoked by his own play. Certainly he was an artist in his particular line of work, and whenever I saw Rosane, gloomy and reserved, the thought of the double role that he was playing, I accorded him a certain measure of admiration. On the following evening, when the officer on deck duty heard groans emanating from the darkest corner of the ship, he approached and found a man lying there, his head enveloped in thick gray scarf and his hands tied together with heavy cord. It was Rosane. He had been assaulted, thrown down, and robbed. A card pinned to his coat bore these words: Arsène Lupin accepts with pleasure the 10,000 francs offered by Monsieur Rosane. As a matter of fact, the stolen pocket contained 20,000 francs. Of course, some accuse the unfortunate man of having simulated this attack on himself. But apart from the fact that he could not have bound himself in that manner, it was established that the writing on the card was entirely different from that of Rosane, but, on the contrary, resembled the handwriting of Arsène Lupin as it was reproduced in an old newspaper found on board. Thus, it appeared that Rosane was not Arsène Lupin, but was Rosane the son of a merchant, and the presence of Arsène Lupin was once more affirmed, and that in a most alarming manner. Such was the state of terror amongst the passengers that none would remain alone in a stateroom or wander singly in unfrequented parts of the vessel. We clung together as a matter of safety, and yet the most intimate acquaintances were estranged by a mutual feeling of distress. Arsène Lupin was now anybody and everybody. Our excited imaginations attributed to him miraculous and unlimited power. We supposed him capable of assuming the most unexpected disguises, of being by turns the highly respectable Major Rawson or the noble Marquise de Rivarenne, or even, for we no longer stopped with accusing letter R, or even such a person well known to us having wife, children, and servants. The first wireless dispatches from America brought no news. At least the captain did not communicate any to us, and the silence was not reassuring. Our last day on the steamer seemed interminable. We lived in constant fear of some disaster. This time it would not be a simple theft or a comparatively harmless assault. It would be a crime, a murder. No one imagined that Arsène Lupin would confine himself to those trifling offenses. Absolute master of the ship, the authorities powerless, he could do whatever he pleased. Our property and lives were at his mercy. Yet those were delightful hours for me, since they secured to me the confidence of Miss Nelly. Deeply moved by those startling events and being a highly nervous nature, she spontaneously sought my side, a protection and security that I was pleased to give her. Inwardly, I bless Arsène Lupin. Had he not been the means of bringing me and Miss Nelly closer together? Thanks to him, I could now indulge in delicious dreams of love and happiness, dreams that I felt were not unwelcome to Miss Nelly. Her smiling eyes authorized me to make them. The softness of her voice gave me hope. As we approached the American shore, the active search for the thief was apparently abandoned, and we were anxiously awaiting the supreme moment in which the mysterious enigma would be explained. Who was Arsène Lupin? Under what name, under what disguise was the famous Arsène Lupin concealing himself? And at last that supreme moment arrived. If I live 100 years, I shall not forget the slight detail of it. How pale you are, Miss Nelly, I said to my companion as she leaned upon my arm, almost fainting. And you, she replied, ah, you are so changed. Just think, this is a most exciting moment, and I am delighted to spend it with you, Miss Nelly. I hope that your memory will sometimes revert. But she was not listening. She was nervous and excited. The gangway was placed in position, but before we could use it, the uniformed customs officers came on board. Miss Nelly murmured, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised to hear that Arsène Lupin escaped from the vessel during the voyage. Perhaps he preferred death to dishonor and plunged into the Atlantic rather than be arrested. Oh, do not laugh, she said. Suddenly I started, and in answer to a question I said, do you see that little old man standing at the bottom of the gangway with an umbrella and olive-green coat? It is Gannard. Gannard. Yes, the celebrated detective who is sworn to capture Arsène Lupin. Ah, I can understand now why we did not receive any further news from this side of the Atlantic. Gannard was here, and he always keeps his business secret. When do you think he will arrest Arsène Lupin? Who can tell? Oh, she exclaimed with that morbid curiosity peculiar to women, I should like to see him arrested. You will have to be patient. No doubt Arsène Lupin has already seen his enemy and will not be in a hurry to leave the steamer. The passengers were now leaving the steamer. Leaning on his umbrella with an air of careless indifference, Gannard appeared to be paying no attention to the crowd that was hurrying down the grand gangway. The Marquis de Riverdam, Major Rawson, the Italian Rivolta, many others had already left the vessel before Roseanne appeared. Poor Roseanne. Perhaps it is he after all, said Miss Nelly to me. What do you think? I think it would be very interesting to have Gannard and Roseanne in the same picture. You take the camera. I am loaded down. I gave her the camera, but too late for her to use it. Roseanne was already passing the detective. An American officer standing behind Gannard leaned forward and whispered in his ear. The French detective shrugged his shoulders and Roseanne passed on. Then, my God, who was Arsène Lupin? Yes, said Miss Nelly aloud. Who can it be? Not more than 20 people now remained on board. She scrutinized them one by one, fearful that Arsène Lupin was not amongst them. We cannot wait much longer, I said to her. She started toward the gangway. I followed. But we had not taken 10 steps when Gannard barred our passage. Well, what is it? I exclaimed. One moment, monsieur. What is your hurry? I am escorting mademoiselle. One moment, he replied. Gazing into my eyes, he said, Arsène Lupin, is it not? I laughed and replied, no, simply Bernard d'Andre. D'Andre died in Macedonia 3 years ago. If Bernard d'Andre were dead, I should not be here. But you are mistaken. Here are my papers. They're his, and I can tell you exactly how they came into your possession. You're a fool, I exclaimed. Arsène Lupin sailed under the name of R. Yes, another one of your tricks. A false scent that deceived them at Havre. You play a good game, my boy, but this time luck is against you. I hesitated a moment. Then he hit me a sharp blow on the right arm, which caused me to utter a cry of pain. He had struck the wound, yet unhealed, referred to in the telegram. I was obliged to surrender. There was no alternative. I turned to Miss Nelly, who had heard everything. Our eyes met. Then she glanced at the Kodak I had placed in her hands and made a gesture that conveyed to me the impression that she understood everything. Yes, there between the narrow folds of black leather in the hollow center of the small object I had taken the precaution to place in her hands before Gannard had registered me, and it was there that I had deposited Roseanne's 20,000 francs and Lady Gerald's pearls and diamonds. Oh, I pledge my oath that at that solemn moment, when I was in the grasp of Gannard and his two assistants, I was perfectly indifferent to everything, to my arrest, to the hostility of the people, everything except the one question, what will Miss Nelly do with the things I had confided to her? In the absence of that material and conclusive proof, I had nothing to fear. But would Miss Nelly decide to furnish that proof? Would she betray me? Would she act the part of enemy who cannot forgive, or that of a woman whose scorn is softened by feelings of indulgence and involuntary sympathy? She passed in front of me. I said nothing, but bowed very low. Mingled with the other passengers, she advanced to the gangway with my Kodak in her hand. It occurred to me that she would not dare expose me publicly, but she might do so when she reached a more private place. However, when she had passed only a few feet down the gangway, with a movement of simulated awkwardness, she let the camera fall into the water between the vessel and the pier. Then she walked down the gangway and was quickly lost to sight in the crowd. She had passed out of my life forever. For a moment, I stood motionless. Then, to Gamard's great astonishment, I muttered, "What a pity that I am not an honest man." Such was the story of his arrest, as narrated to me by Arsene Lupin himself. The various incidents, which I shall record in writing at a later day, have established between us a certain ties of, shall I say, friendship? Yes, I venture to believe that Arsene Lupin honors me with his friendship, and it is through that friendship that he occasionally calls on me and brings into the silence of my library his youthful exuberance of spirits, the contagion of his enthusiasm, and the mirth of a man for whom destiny has not but favors and smiles. His portrait? How can I describe him? I have seen him 20 times, and each time he was a different person. Even he himself said to me on one occasion, "I cannot recognize myself in the mirror." Certainly, he was a great actor, and possessed a marvelous faculty for disguising himself. Without the slightest effort, he could adopt the voice, gestures, and mannerisms of a different person. "Why," said he, "why should I refrain from retain a definite form and feature? Why not avoid the danger of a personality that is ever the same? My actions will serve to identify me." Then he added, with a touch of pride, "So much the better if no one can ever say with absolutely certainty, there's Arsene Lupin. The essential point is that the public may be able to refer to my work and say without fear of mistake, Arsene Lupin did that." Thank you for listening to Reading the Classics on KRBD Ketchikan. Hope you have a wonderful evening. Good night.